I'm here in the studio with Jalal Sabur. Welcome, Jalal.
Welcome. Good morning. Thanks for having me.
Thanks for being here. And like owner-operator of Freedom Farm, right?
Well, Sweet Freedom Farm.
Sweet Freedom Farm, yeah.
The transition from I was living in Wasaic in Dutchess County, and I moved over to Germantown maybe a year and a half ago, 2 years ago, and been farming a little bit, but mostly focused on doing these prison trips with the Victory Bus Project. So that's where a lot of my energy goes into.
Right, your time is going into the Victory Bus Project here lately, and you all and. So the Victory Bus Project, and you've got an exhibit in Catskill right now with the Greene County Council of the Arts,
yeah,
part of their Behind the Bars exhibit that's going on. And so, folks, if you haven't gone down on Main Street to check that out, you really, really need to get down there. Some really powerful stuff. And you all have an exhibit there.
Yeah.
Right? And yeah. So tell me about your exhibit there. Or tell the listeners about it, because I made it down down to the exhibit yesterday. Yeah.
Oh, okay. Yeah. Yeah. Molly, she contacted me about just some of the work that we've been doing and trying to figure out how we can present the Victory Bus Project in our exhibit. And we just came up with the idea to kind of just show some pictures, like a day in the life of the project. And so there's just a few pictures of art exhibit of me like picking up folks.
Right.
So a lot of the work is I pick up people from the city and bring them to facilities up here in the Hudson Valley. And they also get like a package of food.
Okay.
From different farms in the Hudson Valley. And then after their visit, we sometimes do a farm visit. So lot of times there's farms right next to the facilities that we're going to or in the same vicinity on the way back to the city. So we'll stop, have a conversation, have some food, just get to like build relationships with the families that we're bringing on the trips, and talk about different issues and how we can like support them. And you know, we'll bring like community folks out to, you know, just build relationships, just like urban rural relationships. So a lot of that is happening on the trips, and the exhibit is just like, you know, pictures, a day in the life of that, you know.
Okay, so right, so pictures in the day of the life of the Victory Bus Project.
Yeah.
And so Sweet Freedom Farm, and you do this in conjunction with other people, right? With other groups?
Yeah, so basically, the Victory Bus Project is kind of under this Freedom Food Alliance. It's like this larger organization, and it's like a network of like farmers and organizers. And we, you know, we want the families and prisoners, you know, are a part of this organization also.
Right.
It actually started from us going to visit some political prisoners in Sullivan Correctional Facility.
Okay.
So one of my mentors is Herman Bell. And he was in Sullivan Correctional Facility maybe 4 or 5 years ago. But we started visiting him maybe like 6 or 7 years ago, just like having conversations with him to see how we can support him and how we can do some of the work that he was doing. He started this project called the Victory Gardens Project.
Okay.
And he connected with farmers in Maine, and they were growing food in Maine. And through Herman's connections with people in the city, with organizations in the city, they were able to like get the food to people that actually needed it. And so they, you know, Victory Gardens built this whole like network of like volunteers that like got food to like rural communities that needed it and like urban communities that needed it. And this was like before organic was like a thing. So this was like real healthy organic food that they were organizing to get to the folks that actually need it. So this was like, access project, and we knew about that, and we wanted to build with Herman on how we can do something similar. And the idea came up to do transportation, because at the time there was like a free bus that was discontinued. There was like a government free bus that was like cut out.
Oh, so there was a government free bus that helped
that
get people to visit, like prisoners or their family members who were incarcerated.
Yeah. So.
Oh, and it was defunded?
Yeah, it was cut. It was cut because I guess it wasn't needed. But once it was cut, there was like 2,000 families a month that were like cut out from seeing their relatives in prison. So
and it, that kind of thing always makes me wonder who decided it wasn't needed and wasn't being used. Right.
Yeah.
Well, I'm not using it, so we must not need it.
Yeah.
Right.
Uh-huh.
OK.
So and it's crazy. I mean. There was just a, I think, a New York Times article that the Ella Baker Center did a report on the effect of incarceration to families and communities.
I saw that. I saw that recently, and it talked about, and correct me if I'm wrong, the fact that, like, people who are incarcerated need, one, their family, and two, the community support in order to be fully like rehabilitated and to be able to re-enter society. And so when we send people so far away that their family can't visit them, it has a negative impact. It has a negative impact on the community, but it also has a negative psychological impact on the individual. And I guess it would, right?
Yeah. I mean, the article talked about a whole bunch of things, all the impact, but it just said like families, you know, are going into debt by trying to support their relatives. So there's like legal fees. There's like, you know, the commissary fees.
Phone call fees.
It's trying to go to visit. And so like that's the area that we've been focusing on is like making it easier. So these families are not going into debt by trying to like support their relatives that are in prison and incarcerated. And like you say, family support is one of the key indicators in rehabilitation. And so without that family support, you know, a lot of times the recidivism rate is higher.
Yeah.
So people go back into prison without the connection to families.
And I don't know about you, but like I call home every day. I do. I talk to my parents every day.
Nice.
Sometimes it's for 2 minutes. Sometimes it's for 20 minutes. You know, sometimes it's for 30 minutes or whatever. Right.
Yeah.
And so I can't imagine if like what if my family had to pay $4 a minute for that phone call.
Yeah.
Mm-hmm. Right. I mean, it would greatly limit the amount of time that we were able to spend on the phone and connecting. And my family's also in North Carolina, right?
Yeah.
My parents are in North Carolina. So it's not like I can just, you know, go down the road and see my family. So it's the only connection I have to my family right now is via phone call, unless I'm able to like get home. So I can definitely like feel at least in some way, like understanding, you know, maybe not fully understanding, right? Because I'm not and have not been incarcerated. But if that were cut off, you know, that connection, and then my family wasn't able to get to me or I wasn't able to get home or and I didn't know when that would happen, I could definitely see how I would be negatively impacted, like psychologically, because of that.
Yeah, I go see my mom like every weekend mostly.
Mm-hmm.
So, yeah.
Right. Yeah, exactly. Exactly. So the prison industrial complex, right? There is, and for you all who are listening who don't know what this is, it's this idea that the fact that we're building more prisons than we are schools, and we're pipelining certain groups of people, mainly people of color, into prisons faster than we are any other group of people, and often for petty offenses. So what can we do to really help combat this? I mean, I know that you're doing some work with some other agencies and your organization is doing some work around this.
Yeah.
Can you talk a little bit about that?
Yeah. I guess there's like some of the work that is being done is some of the incremental reform efforts.
Yeah.
You know, and a lot of that is great. But I think, like I was telling you before, we just went to see Angela Davis at Vassar.
Right.
And yeah, we've just been having these conversations this week around like Black Lives Matter. And what actually can we do to address it?
Right.
And, you know, the conversation yesterday with Angela Davis was about, or Wednesday, it was about like reimagining prisons. Like, what does this really look like to reimagine prisons? And I think our organization is on the track of like prison abolition. You know, that is like the movement. Like, we need to dismantle what is going on, because we see that it's not working.
So, we see that it's not working. The definition of insanity, right, is doing the same thing and expecting a different result.
Yeah.
We do see that it's not working.
We see, and we see who it's affecting, and we see that this, you know, and it's been, you know, the U.S. is like incarcerating the most people in the world, and you know we have a short percentage, and but so it's like reimagining prisons. And I think the organizations, like with this Freedom Food Alliance, we're trying to build a network of folks that are talking about what does it look like to use food as an alternative to prisons.
Right.
And how can we reimagine our economy, particularly in upstate New York, that is, you know, a farm economy in Columbia County. There's tons of farms. And it used to be more. And so how do we figure out how can we use this economy where we have land that has been taken over by prisons and kind of like reintegrate ourselves back into our farm economy that is actually like getting food to people that need it and building sustainability practice and good for the earth, you know, versus like these prisons that are like warehousing black and brown folks and depleting the earth and, you know.
And, you know, I think it's interesting that, you know, the question is, how can we do that here when I've seen this being done in other places? So in New Haven, where I was living prior to moving to this area, there's something they've got, like a reentry project that takes, I believe it's inmates and people who are on probation and parole, and they teach them like urban gardening skills and farm skills, right? So that when these folks, as they're working to reintegrate into society, they're building skills, right? Working with other people. And they're also building self-worth, right, and value, much of which has been stripped away while they're in prison, right? Because that's the real goal of prison, right, is to strip you of all your self-worth and of all your dignity and then send you back out into society and then not create a way for you to fully function, regardless of what people say the purpose of prison is. Like, my experience of that, having been a law enforcement officer and working with people who, you know, were ex-offenders, right? And having conversations with them, right, about, you know, their experiences in prisons is what they shared with me, you know, that there were maybe only a handful of people who treated them like they were human while they were incarcerated, right? And so they, I think it's really great, the work that you all are doing. And, you know, it's really, really necessary. And there's so much land here. You know, there's so much land here.
Yeah. And it can create empowerment. So it's like, for us, it's like looking at land has always been a key to power. You know, land is power. If you real estate, you know, either way, like when you're talking about it in a rural setting or you're talking about it in an urban setting, you know, that's what people are fighting for. That's what wars have been over. You know, when we talk about today, gentrification, you know, it's about land and that power. And so thinking about the redistribution of land and how can we actually like use it for, you know, a positive impact in the world versus like a negative impact.
How can we use it for a positive impact? And then I think about, you know, all the farmers in this country who are paid to not farm their land, right? Which is the other part of what we don't talk about. You know, when we look at food and food scarcity and food deserts and lack of access to like fresh fruits and vegetables in communities. And then, you know, the federal government actually pays farmers in this country like not to farm their property. And then we bring in produce from other countries. And that is problematic in and of itself, because we could be creating jobs for people in this country. We could be building skills of people in this country. Now, and then I was so excited when I met you, because I have a background in environmental science, and, you know, part of my work was looking at, my research was looking at how do we connect people of color to the environment. Low income people, and I don't like the term at risk, but at risk youth, you know, how do we make those connections? And, you know, some of what we did was we took young people to work on farms, you know, but the area that I was in, there were no black farmers in the area that I was in. And so what you ended up doing was taking these kids to farms that weren't run by people of color. And I'll never forget, I had two young Hispanic women with me, and we had gone to, you know, this, we'd gone to, like, I don't know, do something like pick blueberries.
Yeah.
And so we're picking blueberries, and they look at me and they say, so how come everybody that's here, that the, all the workers look like us? Man, I was like, oh, wow. Hadn't even thought about that, you know? And we had a conversation about race, right? And economics, and the some of the real disparities that take place when we look at how, like, people are treated and how workers are treated and that sort of thing. And, you know, had and one of the young women shared with me that at school, you know, that at school, her teacher, and they were both in high school, when if she didn't do something fast enough, the teacher would say things to her like, what, do I need to say it in Spanish for you to understand?
Mm.
Like, is that what I need to do? Yeah. And so the look on your face is kind of priceless right now. But when she, but she's telling me this, you know, and so I think it's really important that young people, right, all young people have people to look up to who are their same race, their same ethnicity, you know. And what we found, you know, and what we know about the prison industrial complex is our system has done a really good job of incarcerating black men, right? I mean, for us to be, you know, we have the largest prison population out of any other country in the world, and the majority of those people that are incarcerated are African-American men, right? So people who then, when they come out of prison, are looking, maybe looking for meaningful ways to contribute to society, but then those opportunities, doors are often, you know, closed on them because now they have a record.
Yeah.
You know, and now they have a record that continues to follow them sometimes their entire lives. And people, a lot of people are unwilling to take a chance on them,
mm-hmm.
right? And yeah. just to give them the opportunity to even contribute,
yeah.
you know, whether it's through, like, volunteering an organization or through gainful employment.
Yeah, yeah. I think that's the goal. It's like you, we were talking about, what can people do?
Yeah.
And a lot of it is like those, like I was saying, those some of those reform efforts, like, you know, there's the Ban the Box movement. And so
right.
Ban the Box, when people have to check off, they have they been incarcerated or if they have committed a felony or whatever, making sure that that's not a barrier to employment. And then, you know, it's the same thing with higher education. You know, a lot of times when people are going to school, there's a box. So that, sometimes right. that's a barrier. And so trying to get rid of those barriers, but also looking at, you know, reimagining. What is the alternative to prison? You know,
right.
how do we have, you know, jobs, not prisons? How do we have farms, not prisons? You know,
right.
How do we have mental health, not prisons? You know, all these yeah. things, like, how do we have free education,
right,
not prisons, you know?
Yeah, you make some really good points. Like, how yeah. do we have mental health and not prison? And that's yeah. what I found when I was working in Atlanta, when I was doing law enforcement work there, is that a huge number of the people that I picked up were battling mental illness, right?
Yeah.
I didn't take those people to jail, right? It makes no sense to take someone to jail who's mentally ill.
Yeah.
Though prisons are the largest providers of mental health care in this country. Okay, that says something, folks. You know, when prisons are the largest providers of mental health care, that means most of the people that are there probably don't belong there anyway.
Yeah.
Right? And so I would actually take people to be evaluated. I would take them to the hospital and check them in or whatever to be evaluated, because I realized that prison wasn't the place for them.
Mm-hmm.
But everyone doesn't do that, right?
No.
You catch somebody, you know, doing something, you know, these officers catch somebody doing something that they shouldn't be doing, and, you know, they're lucky if they survive the encounter, which is what we're seeing now, you know, with the advent of, you know, like, smartphones and greater access to technology for all people.
Yeah. And that's what has come in place, right? And so
yep.
instead of actually providing jobs or, you know, providing farms that are growing food or, like, actually mental health that people need it, we created a system that is oppressive and has, like, been warehousing black and brown bodies
yeah.
On one end inside the prison and actually, you know, brutalizing, like, murdering people on the other end, you know.
Right.
And so there's been this culture of policing that hasn't actually benefited
black and brown people.
Yeah. And yeah. so it's all need all needs to be reimagined. And that's some of the work that we need people to be doing, is actually creating opportunities that address this structure, you know, right. And like dismantle the structure.
Yeah.
Yeah. And create the alternatives that can actually like benefit our community that's not there yet. And
right.
I think if people have the power to do it, then we need to like actually push them to create the alternatives that can actually be a better solution than what we have right now.
Yeah, you know? I really love that you talk about reimagining the system. And I had a conversation just this week with a woman. I've been invited to be one of their guest, I guess, lecturers. There's a Jewish temple who's teaching Michelle Alexander's book, The New Jim Crow.
Yeah.
And it's open to the public, and they start sometime in October, and it runs for like through November. And, you know, she said, what we realize is that we need to help, right? Mm. Like, mm. we really need to work on solutions too. And, you know, and that's what I've been saying. It's going to take us all, right?
Yeah.
It's going to take not just black and brown people, right? But it's going to take everyone to realize, one, that there's a problem, and two, that we need to do something about it.
Yeah.
You know, because when we look at even, you know, like the greatest movements that have taken place in the history of this country, the movements have, you know, maybe they were started by a group of people, but it really did take everyone like standing together to drive the movements, to really drive the movements forward. And, you know, so, you know, Black Lives Matter. Mm-hmm. Right. And you've got the people, I've been really trying to help people understand that, you know, Black Lives Matter doesn't mean that you like your life doesn't matter, too.
Yeah.
But what it means is that like right now, like black people, like black and brown people are being horribly like disenfranchised by the system. They're being killed by the system disproportionately to the numbers of other groups of people, and that should matter, you know, like that should matter to people.
Yeah, it doesn't. I mean, we were at a talk at Simon's Rock the other day. We was talking about, I was sitting there just getting really upset talking about race relations, and just looking at the media and seeing how when a black person, like when all these people get killed, when Eric Garner got killed, they show it on the media
over and over.
And not to just to compare, but that's what happens, is like you see the hypocrisy when these reporters get killed,
right.
And they don't even think about showing it.
It's
like too graphic.
It.
It's too graphic to show.
Right.
But I've seen Tamir Rice. I've seen our babies get killed
on television over and over again.
And what it shows is that the black body is not really valued.
Right.
And so Black Lives Matter is getting at that point where it's saying that we see this hypocrisy that we have here in America, and it's just like we don't really value black lives,
right.
You know.
But what it also does is it desensitizes the viewer.
Yeah.
Right. Mm-hmm. So when you show that clip over and over and over again, when you show those clips over and over again, it desensitizes. So it works on the subconscious to desensitize the viewer so that when it happens, they don't care.
Yeah.
Mm-hmm. Yeah, you know, and that's what it does. And so can I share an experience that I had this week?
Uh-huh.
Confederate flag. Okay. I was at a meeting. I'm a member of a professional organization that meets in the Greene County area. And I'm at a meeting, and the president of our group has on a T-shirt that's got a Confederate flag on it.
Wow. Okay.
Now, I'm the only member of color, right? I'm the only person of color that is a member of this group that, you know, that shows up. And I was like, wow. And so I spent most of the meeting like disconcerted, you know, by this thing. And I was like, do I say something or will somebody else say something to him?
Yeah.
Right. And so after the meeting, I waited because I was like, well, I can talk to this person. Right. And so I approached the person and I say, you know, so as a woman of color from the South, you know, like the shirt that you're wearing has a Confederate flag on it. And it's, and this is what the Confederate flag basically means to me. And this is what this means for me. And he was like, well, it means something different for everybody. I was like, so you need to, right? Right. I said, so you need to understand that the Confederate flag didn't reappear in our society until people were attempting to oppose the Civil War. I said, after the Confederate War, the Confederate battle flag was put away. It didn't reemerge until, I believe, it was the 1950s.
Yeah.
Right?
Yeah.
And so he says to me, he was like, well, you know, it's like the Nazi flag. It means different things for different people. And in the North, it doesn't mean the same thing. And I was like, no, no, no. I said, oh, okay, so next week you're going to wear a shirt with the Nazi flag on it? Right?
He's just digging himself deeper.
Right? I was like, is that what you're going to do? Like, next week? Is that what you're going to do? Are you going to wear a shirt with, like, a Nazi flag on it next week?
Yeah. And what does it mean in the North? Like, like the argument for Southern pride is gone if you live in the North.
Yeah, right. And that was my thing. It's like, I could, if you were from the South and you were born and raised down in Mississippi or Alabama,
you could try
or whatever,
that argument.
You could try that. You could try that, and it wouldn't sit well with me. But yeah, this was the person's argument, and I finally was just like, wow. I was like, this is just so terrible. I was like, wow, your attitude right now was so... He was like, yeah, my attitude sucks. I was like, yeah, your attitude is really terrible right now. And people say to me, they're like, wow, people actually say these things to you. I'm like, yeah, they do. They do. People say to me generally what they wouldn't say to other people.
Really?
Yeah, I bring that out of people. I'm not sure how, but yeah, I bring that out of people.
So, yeah.
That was a huge digression.
No, I mean, yeah, the Confederate flag and all these things are connected on... Yeah, it's just the hypocrisy that's there. And yeah, I was just thinking even these discussions around like Black Lives Matter and how, you know, this wouldn't happen. And a lot of times it's we were saying like black bodies don't matter. And people get desensitized, but it's like women's bodies don't matter too. And so it's like, that's the other thing. It's like, and then when you put black women together, or like when you put black queer or black trans, it's like they don't even matter at all, you know?
Right. Right. No, you're exactly right. Yeah. And that's not new, right? That is so ingrained in the fabric of our country. You know, when you look at how black women were used for breeding purposes for slaves, black women and black men.
Yeah.
When you look at the decimation of the black family by like slave owners, you know, and so when all of this for me is connected.
Yeah.
Right. They're not separate. And, you know, I feel like, you know, in order to talk about the one piece of it, like we have to really look at how the system has treated black and brown bodies and how the system has really used black and brown bodies to its benefit.
Mm.
Right. And then in those moments when black and brown people have tried to speak up, have really worked to silence black and brown people.
Yeah. Yeah. And it's a history that young people need to be aware of. Old people need to be aware of. Everyone needs to be aware of the history that we have here and actually how do we change it. And so I think it's our obligation to do it once we like realize it. And I think creating the avenues for people and making sure that, you know, people are not comfortable being how we are. And I think that's a lot of the times even black people get comfortable and get desensitized and not are like ready to make action against it. And so coming together over on our uncomfortability of the situation here and actually building the alternatives that need to happen. So it's like this twofold movement that we need to like dismantle and we need to build up, you know?
Right.
And
exactly.
So that's why our, you know, with the Freedom Food Alliance is like, we're talking about farms that we need to build up and we need to have a movement to dismantle what is here now. And then, you know, providing an opportunity for jobs and economic opportunity. So that's a lot of our focus has been, you know, we're trying to turn the Victory Bus into a cooperative and like a cooperative that can provide jobs to folks that are like formerly incarcerated or to young people that need work and seeing how there's models in Puerto Rico where there's been cooperatives with inside prisons.
Right.
That are connected to the outside.
Right.
And so seeing if we can do that here in New York, where we're building cooperative businesses that are within the prisons that once, you know, people come home, they already have a job lined up because they've been a part of this cooperative structure. So providing those, you know, economic opportunities at the same time while dismantling, you know, the system that we have now.
Yeah. Well, I think it's awesome, the work that you're doing.
Yeah.
And you have an event coming up, right?
Oh, we have an event tonight in Albany at the Social Justice Center. I think it's 33 Central Ave. at 6 o'clock tonight. My friend Natasha Bowen, she wrote a book called The Color of Food. Okay. So it's about farmers of color throughout the country, different practices from like Native folks to Black folks, that all farmers of color and their practices. And so our kickoff event is tonight for this tour.
Okay, and it's tonight at what time?
Tonight at 6 o'clock. And the farm that we're highlighting is SoFi Farm. It's going to be all projects within the Alliance. So SoFi is one of the projects within the Alliance. And so they're going to be there talking about some of their work, like I was saying, around restorative justice. And they have a awesome apprenticeship program that people actually like learn, you know, skills. And then we do a Black and Latino farmer immersion. So all the work that SoFi Farm is doing, they're going to be presenting tonight in Albany at 6. So yeah, just come out if you're in the area. There's a Facebook called The Color of Food that has all the dates. We're going to be in Ithaca on Sunday, and then in October 8th, we're having an event in Hudson at Kite's Nest.
Oh, great.
To support the Victory Bus Project. And then me and Natasha are going to be at Omega October 11th. So all the dates are on the Facebook event. So check that out.
The Color of Food.
The Color of Food / Freedom Food Alliance. Yeah, if you just look that up, and you'll see. And yeah, that's some stuff. And yeah, if you want to connect, you can always reach out to me. The website that I check most is the sweetfreedomfarmny.com, or you can always just email me directly. Is Jalal, jalal.sabur@gmail. That's it.
All right. Well, Jalal, thank you so much for coming on today.
That's it. It went quick.
Yeah, it does. It goes by fast.
Okay.
Yeah, it goes by fast. Thank you so much for coming on. And you're always welcome to come back here in the studio and give us updates on what you all are doing with the Victory Bus Project and with your Sweet Freedom Farm.
Yeah, I'd love to come back and maybe talk when it gets closer to the October 8th date. If people remind people that we're going to be at Kite's Nest. And we, you know, Kite's Nest is, we did a summer program there. We did a SJLA. Mm-hmm. It was like a social justice leadership camp.
Right.
And we had young people in Hudson help us do some organizing work. And so for this event, we have an after-school program called Space 101 that a lot of the young people are going to help put this together, and we're going to like dedicate meals to farmers of color and probably have them speak about some of the work they're doing also. So, yeah, it should be good.
That's great. Jalal Sabur from Sweet Freedom Farm, thank you so much for coming in and for being here in the studio with me today. And, you know, you all need to really make sure that you go downtown in Catskill on Main Street to the Greene County Council of the Arts and check out the Behind the Bars exhibit. You can see pictures from the Victory Bus Project there. You can also see Henrietta's exhibit there, Henrietta Mantooth. She was here in the studio with me last week.
One of our youth also has an exhibit at the Catskill, Jasmine Wise.
Oh, really?
One of the youth that we were working with in SLA, she has an exhibit of the effects of mass incarceration on Black women. So please, yeah, check that out also.
Yeah, so check that out. Get downtown and check it out. It will be there through, I think, mid-November.
Yeah.
All right. Well, thanks a lot, Jalal.
Thank you, Michelle. All right.